Okay.
Just kidding.
You're not allowed to see.
You're set?
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, so let me start by explaining my plan for the next 3 days. So the first lecture, I sketched a proof of the disproof of the triangulation conjecture, and I mentioned that the key thing is to construct a map beta from theta 3h to z that lifts the Rachlin invariant. So, and in turn, that beta is based on a construction of Seiberg-Wiedenfeld homology. So what I want to do in the second lecture today is to explain the construction of Seiberg-Wiedenfeld homology. So there are several. There's the S1 equivariant one and the Pinto equivariant ones. And in fact, there are more. One can define generalized homologies, such as stable homotopy or K-theory. And they all come from the same thing, from a Seiberg-Wiedenfeld spectrum. In the second lecture, I mean the third lecture tomorrow, I will give more details about beta. So I will explain the construction in a bit more detail and the properties that we need, the duality and the invariance under homology cobordism. And finally, the last lecture, I was thinking to do something sort of unrelated to the triangulation conjecture, but another application of these methods. So this this is going to be about applications of Seiberg-Wiedenfeld K-theory. So this is one of the generalized homology, generalized homologies that come from these constructions, and it has its own application to low-dimensional topology, namely to restricting intersection forms for four manifolds with boundary. Okay, so so throughout this lecture, Y3 is going to be a closed, oriented three manifolds, and right, and well, so for simplicity, I'm mostly going to assume that Y is a homology sphere, but some of the things can be done in more generality. So one, so the traditional Seiberg-Wiedenfeld homology is S1 equivariant. So it depends on Y and the choice of a spin C structure on Y. This is also denoted HM2 of YS in Kronheimer Mrafka's book. And it's meant to be a... and this is... this is supposed to be the Morse homology for the CSD functional. So I will explain that what this is, but so the idea is you count critical points and you count flow lines. So of course, for this to work, you need to make sure that your functional is Morse male in a certain sense. Well, you're in infinite dimensions, but anyway, there's no reason for CSD to be like that. For so what you need to do is to choose an appropriate perturbation, and for generic perturbations, this would be the case. So this is the traditional construction. So there, yes. So there are basically two different kinds of constructions. So one method is to use generic perturbations to achieve transversality. So this is the traditional methods. It's also what's done to construct the Gromov-Witten invariants, for example. And in the Seiberg-Witten case, so this was done by Kornheimer and Mrafka in their book. So this was this is the most general version. It works for all three manifolds. A different construction is due to Froyshov, and another one by Marcoli and Wang. These are just for this only work basically when B1 equals zero. and maybe for non-torsion spin-spin structures. So right. It's okay. okay. Great. So I mean, the one big difficulty in this case is to make it S1 equivariant and to make sense of. I mean, to do something about equivariance, and they do different things to deal with that. But what I want to talk about is a second method. So this is what I did a long time ago, well, 12 years ago. So there's another method which is based on finite dimensional approximation. And the Cauley index. So this is what I want to talk about. So let me just mention some differences between 2 and 1. So, one disadvantage of this method is that at the moment it only works well for B1 of y equals 0, whereas Kronheim and Mrówka, they do it in full generality. However, there is a student of Mrówka, Kandawit, who is now working on extending it for all three manifolds. But what is good about it is that, you know, it avoids these transversality issues. As you will see, there is no need to choose generic perturbations. Another thing that's good about it is that it gives this generalized homology theories rather than just usual homology. It's easy to incorporate the Pintu symmetry. So in order to do equivariant flow homology, there were various tricks, like Kronheimer and Mrówka, they do a blow-up, and then they divide by S1 and work on manifolds with boundaries. If you want to have the additional symmetry, so to go from S1 to Pintu, it may be possible to follow their work, but this method seems easier, and this is what I did. So I should also mention that there's some work in progress that I'm doing with Tai, which would say that 1 is equivalent to 2. They give the same answer for the S1 equivariant case, at least. All right. So this is what I used to define the Pintu equivariant Seiberg-Wiedmann flow homology. All right. So with that in mind, let me start by writing down the Seiberg-Wiedmann equations. So we have a three manifold. So for this to work well, we need to assume that B1 equals 0. For simplicity, I'm actually going to assume that H1 equals 0, so not just with rational coefficients, but with integer coefficient. That's all you need for triangulations. To write the equations, you need to pick a metric, G. So if Y is a homology sphere, then there exists a unique spin C structure. So that simplifies things a little bit. We don't have to keep track of spin C structures, but I should say what this is. So S, a spin C structure consists of a rank 2 complex vector bundle over Y with a Hermitian metric. And an identification between the tangent space of Y and the space of skew adjoint, traceless, and the morphisms of S. So this is SU, the Lie algebra SU of S. It's a subspace of the endomorphisms of S that satisfy trace of A equals 0 and A plus A star is equal to 0. So to every rank 2 bundle, you can associate the corresponding Lie algebra bundle where the fiber at every point is a copy of SU2, and it varies according to the bundle. And what we want is for this to be identified to Ty. This corresponds to a lift, so having this structure corresponds to lifting the structure group of the three manifold from SO3 to spin C of 3. So this is called the Clifford multiplication. And it induces, I mean, Ty is the same as T star Y because we have the metric. And then if you want, we can also complexify. And now we get to the complexify Lie algebra, which is just all traceless endomorphisms of S. This is also an isomorphism. So there, I mean, I don't want to get into the general theory of spin C structures, but in this case, there's a unique spin C structure, and this can be seen quite explicitly. I mean, the construction can be made quite explicit. So Ty is a three-manifold, and Ty is trivial. So you can trivialize Ty. Let's say you find a frame of sections, E1, E2, E3. And then for the bundle S, you just take the trivial bundle. And for the map, rho, I mean, with the usual Hermitian metric, and
are
rho...
Are brackets on Ty, you know, vector fields, are they the same as this bracket, or they're not?
Sorry, this?
I mean, the thing on the right is a Lie algebra.
Oh, yes. Sorry, no. These are Ty, yes, and they will go to the... These are just frame. These are just the vector fields. And the row is going to take them to a basis of the Lie algebra.
But not the point-wise.
Okay, so it doesn't.
Sorry. Oh, yes. No, it doesn't have to do with the Lie algebra on vector fields. Yes, sorry. Yes. So rho of E1 is going to be I0, 0 minus I. So these are the Pauli matrices. Rho of E2 is 0 minus 1, 1, 0. And rho of E3 is 0, I0. So that's very explicit. And, well, one can show that up to isomorphism of spin C structure, this is unique. So it doesn't depend on how you trivialize. All right, so next, I think I have all the things I need to write down the Cyber-Gwidden equations. So let me write them down in Coulomb gauge. So in general, they're invariant under an action of the gauge group, but I can fix the gauge. So that means that I'm going to restrict. So there are equations for a pair, A and phi, which lives in this space V, I kernel of the star plus sections of S. What this is, the kernel of the star is a subset of I omega 1 of Y of the imaginary valued forms on Y. And doing Coulomb gauge basically corresponds to restricting to the kernel of D star. So the equations SW of A phi R0 are the following two set of equations, star DA. So for simplicity, usually it's about connections and spinners. So sections of this are called spinners. And connections Well, usually you work with spin-C connections. In this case, when you have a homology sphere, there is a unique flat connection, and I can just identify all connections with forms. So that's why it's easier to just write them in terms of forms. So star dA minus 2 rho inverse phi tensor phi star 0 equals 0, and del bar phi plus rho a phi is equal to 0. I guess I have to say what del bar is. Del bar is just sum from I equals 1 to 3, rho e I del I. So this is the Dirac operator. It acts on spinners, on sections of S. All right, so let me pause for a moment. So explain what's going on here. So this is the Clifford multiplication. These are elements of TY. So Clifford multiplications acts by endomorphisms, and del Y are just the usual derivatives in these directions. So you think of sections of S as just functions, and then these are the usual derivatives with respect to this frame. And then you act on each of them by the corresponding Clifford multiplication of EI. So that's the Dirac operator. And the second equation is actually the Dirac operator corresponding to the this is the Dirac operation for the flat connection, and this is the Dirac operation for another connection, for the one corresponding to A. And here, so star dA is also a one form, and phi tensor phi star is an endomorphism of S. You take the zero means taking the traceless part, which makes this an element in here, and rho inverse maps it back to T star Y complexified, and you want that to be equal to star dA. Okay, so I wanted to write them down. I'm not really going to use much about them. I mean, of course, you have to use the specific form to prove compactness and other things, but I just wanted to have them on the board, but most of the talk is not really going to use their particular form. Okay, so one thing to important about the Cyber-Guitton equations is that they have a pin-2 symmetry. So let me remind you from yesterday's talks, pin-2, which is sometimes also called pin-2 minus, there are two pins, is the group made of S1 union S1j inside of C plus Cj, which are the quaternions. So it's made of two copies of S1. Where j squared equals minus 1, and the way this acts is ei theta in S1 acts on a phi by a ei theta phi. This is what's left of the gauge group after we ended up in Coulomb gauge. We kind of divided, by imposing the condition d star of a equals 0, we divided out by most of the gauge, but we still have these constant gauge transformations. And then j of a phi is minus a and phi j, where so j acts on phi, so you can think of this as the quaternions. If we think of them as sections of C2, then this is just taking V1, V2 to minus V2 bar, V1 bar. So this is conjugation symmetry, and since we are on a homology sphere, the spin-C structure is preserved. In fact, it's a spin structure, and the spinors are a quaternionic bundle having this action of J. And one can check, so I don't want to check, but that the Seiberg-Witten equations are preserved by, I mean, are invariant under this symmetry. Okay. Another thing that one can notice is that we can write the Seiberg-Witten equations as the gradient of a functional. That's the CSD functional. So this is a map from V to R. Let me write it down as well. CSD A phi is 1/2 integral of y phi del bar A phi, where del bar A phi is this, del bar phi plus rho A times phi, minus integral of y A wedge dA. Yes, this is the Chern-Simons part, and this is the spinorial part. All right, any questions so far?
If we were doing this on a spin-free manifold, not necessarily a homology three-sphere, does that mean that we actually choose a trivialization of the determinant of the spinner bundle? Really has to be trivial.
Yes, you choose a trivialization. You have to choose a spin structure. For J2.
In general, it's slightly more data than a spin C structure with C1 equals.
That's right.
But it would act on general spin C structures. Well, it would take the opposite spin C structure.
Yes, that's also true. Yes. Okay, so the next thing that I want to do is, let me state the compactness theorem and then do finite dimensional approximation. So the idea is that instead of doing flirt theory, meaning more homology on this infinite dimensional space V, we're going to approximate it by finite dimensional spaces. So for that, it's worth noticing that the Seiberg-Witten equations can be written as can be decomposed into L and C. L is just the linearization of zero. And this is given by, star D and del bar. And if you are on, since we are restricted to kernel of the star, this turns out to be elliptic. The Dirac operator is also elliptic. So this is a linear, elliptic, and self-adjoint operator. And C, as for C, C is called C because it's compact in a certain sense. So for that, we should really think of SW. So SW is just the left-hand side of those two equations together. You can think of it as a map from V to V. It takes A and phi to another form and another spinner. So it can be extended to a map between Sobolev completions. So VK is the L to K Sobolev completion of V. This map C, it's basically quadratic. So for K large, what happens is that C actually takes VK into VK. And then if you want to think of SW as a map to VK minus 1, the inclusion of VK is compact. Oops. It's compact. So together the map C would be compact if you go from VK to VK minus 1. It's compact and nonlinear, but it takes like bounded sets to compact sets. Okay, so now let me state the compactness theorem. So this is the main result we'll need from usual Seiberg-Witten theory, or the Seiberg-Witten equations, is that all the critical points and finite energy gradient flow trajectories of CSD. So things like x dot equals minus nabla CSD of x. And you have to impose the finite energy conditions. They live inside a ball of a certain radius in Vk. Let's say fixing k for some r greater than 0. So that's what's, well, that's what's good about the Cyber-Gridden equations. Well, if you could achieve transversality, right? So in principle, you don't know. You could have manifolds of them, and anyway, you have an S1. Symmetry. So achieving transversality usually means finding a finite number of circles and then some point that's reducible. Okay. So now I think we're ready for finite dimensional approximation. So this was first used by Furuta in dimension 4, where he proved his 10-8 theorem using finite dimensional approximation. And the interesting thing is that you can also do it, well, it's slightly different in dimension 3. So L is a self-adjoint elliptic operator. It's going to have a discrete spectrum going to plus and minus infinity. So what we're going to do is look at some cutoffs, tau much less than 0 and nu much bigger than 0. And we're going to define v nu tau to be the direct sum of all the eigenspaces of L with eigenvalues in T, well, nu. There's some convention here. You want to go between open, closed, but roughly we're just cutting off. So this approximates, this is finite dimensional, and, well, the union of all of them is dense inside of V. So this is my finite dimensional approximation for V, and now I'm just going to restrict CSD to V nu tau. Yes, I think this ends up having the form L plus some projection P nu tau of C. So L, of course, preserves V nu tau, when C does not, but we can think of C as, a, well, it's compact, so we can think of it as some sort of perturbation of L. So the hope is that this doesn't change L plus C that much. And indeed, so the key fact is that we also have a compactness result for the approximate trajectories. So this was for ordinary trajectories in infinite dimensions. Now in finite dimensions, it's slightly different. So there exists R such that for all nu and, I guess, minus tau much bigger than 0, all critical points and flow lines. Of CSD restricted to V nu tau that stay inside B of 2R, actually stay inside B of R. Okay, so what am I saying here? Now, I can't quite say that everything is compact, like in the infinite-dimensional case. All I can say is that I have some critical points of this restriction. Well, there may even be manifolds of them. And there may be some that are far off to the infinity, but what the theorem says is that there will not be any between B of R and B2R. And similarly, in terms of flow lines, I have some flow lines in here, and I have some flow lines in here, and I may even have flow lines like this, and also flow lines going off to infinity. But what I am not allowed to have is... Oh, I should have drawn that in green, but too late. So what I'm not allowed to have is this. Also flow lines that stay inside B2R but don't stay inside B of R. And the reason for this is actually, why this is the right theorem to prove, it's because L plus, this L plus P nu tau C well, it goes to L plus C uniformly, but only on bounded sets, such as B to R. So it doesn't approximate it, because it doesn't approximate it uniformly overall. If we're looking at, P nu tau of anything is... let's say of a single point that goes to zero, but at every, but not in a uniform way. I mean, for if you just fix the norm of x, then like p nu tau does not go to one in the operator norm. So, however, if I restrict to a bounded set, then C applied to that bounded set makes it compact, and then on compact sets, P nu tau does approximate 1 nicely. So this is kind of the key analytical input, is that the nonlinear part of the Seiberg-Witten equation is compact if you choose the right Sobolev completions, and therefore if you restrict to a ball to start with, then what you show is that basically this approximates L plus C. So everything that lives inside B to R actually approximates a trajectory from here. It approximates a trajectory of L plus C, and those we know that they live inside a smaller ball, B of R. And therefore the original ones have to be inside B of R as well. That's true, yes, yes. I could have said anything, yeah, just anything bigger than R, yeah. I could have said for any k greater than R, then for mu and minus tau much larger than zero, but that would depend on k, then if they stay inside B of k, they stay inside B of R. Um, Okay, so what do we do now? Well, now we're in finite dimensions, and what I would like to do is basically ignore what happens near infinity. So this is the kind of stuff that does not approximate the original Cyber-Witten equations, and we don't care about it, but rather we're just looking at what happens in this ball. And here we have, we have a finite dimensional flow. If we want, we can achieve transversality. It's a bit more... We could even achieve, equivariant transversality is a bit more difficult, and then we could define the Morse homology in here. However, this is not what you're supposed, this is not what's the easiest thing to do in finite dimensions. If you have a manifold in finite dimensions, instead of doing Morse theory, you could just take its singular homology. So that's what we're going to do here as well, except that our manifold is not compact. We are in this ball inside a vector space, and we have a flow. So instead of taking the singular homology of the manifold, we have to take the homology of the Conley index. So let me now introduce the Conley index. I'm going to look at S. S was the spinner bundle. But okay, now we have another S. It's okay. S is the union of... critical points and trajectories inside inside B of R, B of 2R and intersect V nu tau. Trajectories of CSD restricted to V nu tau. Okay, so this is what's called an isolated invariant set in the flow. So it's invariant, the flow preserves it, and it's isolated in the sense that there is an open neighborhood of it, namely B of R, or if you want B of 2R, such that anything that that comes from such that the only things that stay inside that the invariant part of B to R, so the things that stay inside B to R under the flow are actually S. So S is the invariant part of an open neighborhood. So that's called an isolated invariant set. And to such a thing in any flow, it doesn't even have to be a gradient flow, though in our case it is. You can associate the Conley index I of S. It's not a number, it's a space. It's defined as n divided by L, where n is a neighborhood of my set. In this case, you can just take it to be the ball. Let's say BR bar. Or, I don't know, maybe, yes, that's fine, because this lives inside the interior. And then L is the exit set, is the part of the boundary of N where the flow exits N. So there are some points where it enters and some points where it exits. And you take the quotient N by L. This is an invariant of S up to Bayes' homotopy equivalence. Of S up to under deformations. Yes. The Conley index is you take a neighborhood of your invariant set and you divide by the part of the boundary where the flow exits. that gives you a space, and the Kahn index theory tells you that this is an invariant under deformation of S up to homotopy equivalence. So if I choose a different neighborhood and you have another exit set, then the two are homotopy equivalent. And if I have a family of flows and S varies continuously, then also they are homotopy equivalent. Let me be a bit more concrete. I'll get to this. Yes. Exactly. Why is it called an index? So if the flow is more Smale, what's important is that the reduced homology of I of S is the Morse homology. So this is an analog, right? Let's say that we are on a compact manifold, and we look at the Morse-Smale flow. Then the Morse homology is the singular homology of M. Well, the Kahn index in this case, you can take the whole manifold to be S, and you can take N to be M, N to be the same as the manifold, and L to be the empty set, and you get that singular homology is Morse homology. So this is a generalization of these two manifolds with boundary, if you want. So the Morse homology is the homology of a neighborhood modulo the exit set, which makes sense because that's how you add handles on the exit set. So the reason why it's called the Kahn index is because it's it generalizes the Morse index. So for example, if it's a gradient flow and let's say S is just a critical point that happens to be non-degenerate, then I of S is what? It's, you can take a neighborhood of the form B of K times B of N minus K, where K is the Morse index of this, and you end up with I of S being this modulo the exit set, ends up being BK over S. Sk, bk over sk minus 1 times dn minus k, and this is homotopy equivalent to s to the k, where k is the Morse index. So, Kahn index theory is kind of a generalization of the Morse index to, in the sense that, you know, the dimension of the sphere determines the sphere. So Conley said that, you know, if you want to do it for arbitrary flows, not necessarily gradient, and arbitrary isolated invariant sets, well, you're not going to get a sphere, so the natural notion is of a space.
That equation, one side is a sphere?
Yes.
Yeah, the other side is just your set, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, yeah. The space. Yeah, so in this case, the space is a sphere, and the dimension is the Morse index, but in general, it's a random space.
Do you need the neighborhood to be compact?
Yes. Yes. N is compact. There are some, there are some technical conditions that I didn't want to get into, like what does L mean? So L is also compact. But roughly, this is how you should think about it. So... So now that's how we can avoid transversality in finite dimensions. Instead of trying to find the perturbations and making it more Smale, we're just going to take this neighborhood and divide by the exit set. So we're going to let I nu tau be the Kahn index for this S, for the Seiberg-Witten flow. In B to R intersect V nu tau. I mean, you have a different S. Maybe I should say S nu tau. Let's call it S nu tau.
You're saying that in finite dimensions, if you just have any old function, it doesn't have any kind of transversality, I can do this thing.
Yes. As long as it's set of critical points and flow lines, is isolated invariant. Like as long as you have this in between neighborhood where you don't have flow lines escaping like this. So you do need this property. Basically, I'm using that S is the invariant part of this whole ball. Okay, so basically what we would like to do is just to define flow homology as the homology of this. Of course, the only thing is that it depends a little bit of nu and tau. So what happens if we increase nu, then in that case I nu tau is unchanged up to homotopy equivalence. But if we decrease tau, so tau is the negative cutoff, then what happens is that I nu tau prime is v tau tau prime plus smash I nu tau. So this is some sort of suspension. So first of all, why does this make sense? If you look at the Conley index, if you look at the Morse index, then if I'm adding, if I'm changing it, if I'm adding to this a new direction and the flow is kind of points positively, then the Morse index doesn't change. But if it points negatively, then it changes from sk to sk plus 1. And that just corresponds to doing the suspension of your space. In general, what you get is you suspend, meaning you take the smash product with the sphere. This is a sphere, corresponding with the to the eigenspaces between tau and tau prime. What you would like to define is Seiberg-Witten-Fleur homology of Y and G to be the reduced homology of I nu tau. But you want to, I'm going to add here the dimension of V0 tau. So what happens is that this I nu tau is not quite the same, but if you do what's called a formal desuspension, so I'll explain in a moment what this is. Let's do sigma minus V0 tau of I nu tau. This is a formal desuspension. This will not depend, so this does not depend on nu and tau up to stable homotopy equivalence. So the natural invariant that you want to construct out of this is kind of not quite a space up to homotopy equivalence, which is what the Conley index was, but rather a suspension spectrum. So a suspension spectrum is, I have some time. Let me also mention, since I'm going to give the definition, let me also involve, let's say, the S1 equivariant. So you could do non-equivariant Seiberg-Witten-Fleur homology, but more useful is to do, let's say, first S1 equivariant. So all our notions are S1 equivariant, including the Conley index, and we can just take the ordinary Borel equivariant homology of this. So let me define my notion of S1 equivariant suspension spectrum. It's just a space where I keep track of suspensions. So it's going to be, the other thing is, in the V, so V nu tau it's part of V, which is made of forms and spinors. So as representations of S1, it's something like R to the A plus C to the B, because S1 acts trivially on forms and it acts on spinors by the complex representation. So to do this right, you have to keep track of how much you suspend by which coordinate. So an S1 equivalent suspension spectrum would just be, let's say, a triple XMN, where M is an integer, and N, for fun, I'm going to take it to be, well, not for fun, but for what we'll see later, I'm going to take it to be a rational number, but you could imagine that it's an integer for now. So this is meant to be the desuspension of X by M copies of the trivial representation and N copies of the complex representation of S1. So X is a space with an S1 action. And you can define a category like this, where the maps between, so the morphisms between XMN and X prime, M prime, N prime are the colimit as, let's say, capital M and capital N go to infinity of S1 equivariant homotopy classes between the suspension of X by M minus M prime copies of, okay, this is going to take longer to write, M minus M prime copies of R and capital N minus N prime, no, minus M minus N copies of CX to sigma M minus M prime R sigma N minus N prime C Y S1 equivariant homotopy classes. So this is, so instead of X up to S1 equivariant homotopy equivalence, I'm going to suspend, so that gives me stable homotopy equivalence, and if I work in this world, I might as well allow formal desuspensions where I, where I subtract here, and this is okay if M and N are large. So this is like a category, and it makes sense now to talk about things like S0, if you want, 5 and 0. That's kind of the minus 5 dimensional sphere. So it's just a formal way of allowing, you now allow the homology to live in negative dimensions. And this is what I'm doing here. So in order for, because this changes with suspension like this, if I desuspend by V0 tau, then I get something that does not depend on tau. And the formal desuspension is just a triple like that. And this is something that's, it can be shown to be an object in this, a well-defined object in this category up to canonical isomorphism. Okay, so let me see. Now, in order to define right. Okay, let's see how much time. Okay. So this still depends on G. I mean, at least I didn't tell you how it depends on G. Now, what happens? We want to have something that does not depend on G. So when we change G, it turns out that I nu tau is unchanged if nu and tau are fixed. So you can do that for small deformations of the metric. You can fix nu and tau, and then such that the eigenvalues do not cross nu and tau. And then this is by the properties, the invariance properties of the Conley index, this is fine. But what is not fine is that now it is suspended by V0 tau. And the dimension of V0 tau does change with the metric. So the way it changes is is by the spectral flow. So let's say we have two metrics G0 and G1. We look at its eigenvalues, other eigenvalues. We have a family of metrics, GT. Well, if you look at V0 tau here versus V0 tau here, even if there are no eigenvalues that cross the tau line, there will be some that cross the zero line. And this is captured by the spectral flow. And it's just the spectral flow of the Dirac operator. Rather, I mean, D star does not have spectral flow. This is given by the difference of two eta invariants, eta yg1 and eta yg0, where eta yg let me actually not say what it is right now. I'm going to say it tomorrow, but it's a rational number. So what you want to do to actually define an invariant, and this is going to be the Seibert-Guitton-Fleur spectrum of Y, is to disuspend further by this eta of G. So I'm going to let this to be sigma minus eta of YG. I guess this is the real dimension, so I probably want to divide by 2. And it's just on the Dirac operator, so it's copies of the C representation times what I had before, sum of minus V0 tau I nu tau. And this turns out to be an invariant of Y itself. And somehow the interesting thing is that this is... This is, in this case,
really?
It is rational. Okay, in general, okay. In principle, eta invariants are real numbers. In this case, it is rational for rational homology spheres, but it actually turns out to be an integer for when h1 of y is equal to 0. But in general, it's a rational number for B1 equals 1. Yes, for all metrics. And
zero.
Oh, yes, B1 equals 0. Maybe I will explain tomorrow why that's the case, because this is related to the Rochlin invariant. So this will play an important role in the construction of beta. But for now, yeah, so actually, well, we're going to need this for pin 2 anyway. So the definition of Seibert-Guitton-Fleur, well, this kind of construction for S1 equivariant Seibert-Guitton-Fleur homology is just the reduced homology of this SWF of Y, or equivalently, it's the homology of this I nu tau, where you add these things, dimension of V 0 tau minus eta of yg. Oh, I think I made a mistake then. Eta yg is a minus. This should be plus. Okay, so this is what you can do. Now, of course, you can do the same with anything else. So if h is some generalized, and if you want, it can be equivariant or non-equivariant homology theory or cohomology theory, such as K-theory. We can similarly define SWF little h S1 or not S1, I mean, whatever equivariance you want of Y. So you can do equivariant K-theory or ordinary K-theory or stable homotopy. By just applying the corresponding theory to SWF of Y. So finally, we can do the same for pin 2. So we can also incorporate the pin 2 equivariance into the theory. Everything is just pin 2 equivariant, the Conley index, and all that. And we can define similarly SWFH star pin 2 of Y, the same way, just. 15. So the Pinto equivariant homology of I nu tau plus that the same shift in dimension. And you can similarly make sense of a spectrum. It's a yes, it's so if you want to be careful about the suspension coordinates in this case, are two representations of pin 2 that are important. So you kind of have to include the trivial representation because, the morphisms are actually groups. But the ones that are important are R tilde, which is, how it acts on forms, and namely just J acts non-trivial on J acts by minus 1 is the sine representation. That corresponds to what happens on A, and then the quaternionic representation, which is what happens on phi. So you So you keep track of suspensions by R tilde and H, and in this case you have to do eta divided by 4 times H. So somehow you do end up with rational numbers if the corresponding thing is. If it's not even. So that will have something to do with the Röcklin invariant. Okay, so this is the definition of the Fleur homologies. So tomorrow I will explain how to go from here and use the properties of Pinto equivariant homology to define the beta invariant and explain a bit about its properties. So I'll stop here.
Question? Can you explain again how you get numbers A, B if you know the eigenspaces of the linearization?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so V nu tau is a direct sum of eigenspaces between nu and tau, and A is the dimension of those eigenspaces. So the eigenspaces come into two types, those of the star D operator on forms and those of the Dirac operator on spinors. And A is the dimension of the first and B is the dimension of the latter.
What is the analogous thing?
It's R tilde, yes, so exactly. So if this is R A plus CB, that's good, then the corresponding thing for P2 would be R tilde A plus H to the B over 2. So B is always even because we have a quaternionic structure on spinners, and if you keep track of the P2 action, then this is the corresponding decomposition here.
Other questions? Let's thank Chip in again.